All right. So we're going to do a series on Christian evidence. Now, we're going to do a number of them. This one is on the existence of God. Now, this is kind of silly to do this, right? How many of you believe in God? All right. So why even bother doing a lesson on the existence of God?
So we can convince other people.
All right. Yeah. And the bottom line is all of us have doubts. Probably not to the extent of doubting that God exists. Okay, probably not. But you know, somebody somewhere is going to throw something out there and it's going to throw you for a loop.
Oh, yeah.
All right? And so it's forewarned is forearmed. Okay, so this is, I've taught like entire, you know, 15-hour, 20-hour classes on Christian evidence many times in different places. This is the typical curriculum. In fact, we have a 100-hour Christian evidences certificate that you can take if you want. 100 hours worth of material,
wow.
10 classes. And this is more or less the content in that program. So we'd cover the existence of God. We'd cover evidences related to who Jesus is, messianic prophecies, his claims, miracles, and his resurrection. Then we'd cover topics related to the authority and inspiration of the Bible. We will do all three of those, contradictions, how we got the Bible and inerrancy and inspiration. Then history, archaeology, science, other religions, worldview, defense of Christian theology, answering hard questions. That's typical. All right, so why should we study Christian apologetics? Now, Hebrews 11:1 seems to imply that we shouldn't. Seems to. Hebrews 11, verse 1, says, faith is confidence in what we hope for and assurance about what we do not see. That is what the ancients were commended for. There are Christian theologians and scholars who believe it's bogus to do Christian evidences. Because in the end, they say, faith, it's like a leap into the dark. And they believe, ultimately, it just comes down to belief in things you can't see. And if you have evidence, that's something you can see. And faith is belief in things you can't see. What are some of the things that you can't see? God? Heaven? Hell? A lot of stuff. So some people argue, and by the way, there's even a name for this. These people are called fideists. A fideist, which is Latin for faith, fide. A fideist is one who believes the basis of our faith is simply faith. And any attempts to prove Christianity is defeating the whole point of having faith. Now I think that's just a load of baloney, okay? But I think there is some truth to that. Because in the end, trusting God is trusting him about things for which you have no evidence. Because if you have evidence, then you're not trusting God. All right, so here's how I think about it, though. As we provide evidence that provides support to our faith, that allows us to step even further out in faith. So if you have an evidence-less faith, that means you'll be able to step out on that faith less far, I believe. So, Christian evidence is not the most important topic in Christianity. Jesus is the most important topic in Christianity. All right, but I do believe, especially in a college setting where people are asking questions, that this is a good place to be. And of course, there's the famous scripture in 1 Peter that says, always be prepared to give an answer to anyone who asks you for the reason for the hope that you have. All right? So, by the way, there's different kinds of approaches to doing apologetics. One is the cumulative case apologetics. Another one is classical apologetics of Thomas Aquinas. And Thomas Aquinas said you start by proving the existence of God. You establish that first, everything comes after that. And anyway, there's other kinds. There's worldview apologetics. I don't care. What, to me, the apologetics is a good one, is the one that works. And I don't care all about these arguments. They have debates about all this stuff. I think it's a waste of time. Now, we could separate kinds of evidential support to Christianity into two categories. One category would be those kinds of evidences that are primarily geared or useful in defending those who already believe against the critics. All right? And that would include history and archaeology. In other words, if you were to show somebody, look at this archaeological find, they wouldn't go, man, I need to get baptized. You know what I'm saying? All right? So that kind of evidence doesn't cause people to seek Jesus. But the fact is, as believers, you got on the web and all, they'll say Moses wasn't a real person, they'll say all kinds of stuff. By the way, some of which is actually true, others of which are flat out lies. And so we need to know about that. Also, sort of the whole defending the reliability of the text itself, which you're not defending the Bible, the autographs, the original writings, you're defending the version that we have. So how to defend this thing here, that this is the Word of God. So we'll talk about that. Okay, science in the Bible, you know, it kind of supports the Bible, but, you know, when you look at, DNA or, you know, I do a whole thing on science and God and all that kind of stuff. It's not like people say, yeah, I need to become a Christian. So really, when we talk about science in the Bible, that's primarily to defend the faith that people already believe. And then also when you talk about disproving claims that there's contradictions and all that sort of stuff. Okay, good. But the kind of apologetics that I'm way more into, honestly, is the kind where you can use to share with people and they kind of go, Oh, wow. I better check out Christianity. I need to check out Jesus. So that's the kind that I speak on these topics many times, as you probably know. And so these are the ones that I find I'm much more like teaching or talking about. And so, messianic prophecies, types, prefigures, and foreshadows. Talking about evidence for miracles, evidence for the resurrection, the claims of Jesus, defense of the Christian worldview. These are things that are awesome for evangelism. So we're going to do some of those. Take notes. But take notes in both of them. All right, so we're going to talk about the existence of God. I'm going to defend the idea that God exists. Okay? Now, my argument is going to have three parts. First of all, what I'm going to do is I'm going to argue that God doesn't exist. And by the way, I've been involved in three debates. I haven't been in a lot of debates. I've actually put together and organized more debates than I've actually done. But one of the debates I did, I lost. I was defeated in that debate. And the premise I took was that God does not exist. Now, my opponent was a senior in high school. He was, what do you call it, the top dog, what do you call that, the? He was the valedictorian, and he went to Berkeley, pretty smart guy. So he was defending that God does exist, and I defended that God didn't exist. And when I did it, and then he went second. And after I did my God doesn't exist thing, it was for teenagers. The teenagers were like,
oh, wow.
Whoa. Cause I did it real. I wasn't kidding. Yeah. And then my opponent, he defended the idea that God is real. And at that point, the audience was like, okay. It was in the rebuttal phase that he dusted me. Cause what it would revealed is I was just using a lot of rhetoric and a lot of fine sounding words. What I didn't have is a good argument or evidence. So it was in the rebuttal phase that he was able to undermine what I'd said and prove that it was just a bunch of hot air. I don't know about malarkey. So I'm going to I'm going to make the atheist's argument against the existence of God. Then I'm going to show why those arguments fall apart of their own weight without even trying to prove that God exists. Then I'm going to present 3 or 4 arguments for the existence of God. All that in 30 minutes. So, 35 minutes. Okay. By the way, normally when I do Christian evidences talks, and I've done them, done hundreds of these, normally we have a question and answer session. Uh-huh. All right? And so, we'll do that. So, come up with some questions. Otherwise, it'll get kind of, you know, it's like, it'll be kind of, anyway. All right, so I'm going to argue that God does not exist. And I'm going to present 4 arguments. One of the argument is, you cannot observe God, and if you can't observe something, that means it's not real. Another argument I can make, which is a terrible argument, which is, the believers are just a bunch of hypocrites, so obviously, therefore, the thing they believe in is also not true. All right, my third argument is going to be because in light of this suffering in the world, which disproves God. And my fourth argument is that, hey, if I can't prove God exists, if you can't prove that God exists, then by default, then he doesn't exist. It's kind of like David Hume said, extraordinary claims require extraordinary proof. Okay? David Hume, the skeptic philosopher, said, extraordinary claims require extraordinary proof. And if you can't show me God, if I can't see God, then then you have to prove to me that he does exist. Otherwise, I win by default. That'll be my fourth argument. Okay? So, God cannot be observed. In fact, on campus today, what, your friend, the guy, the big guy who kind of limps, what's his name? Raphael.
Oh, at Merced College?
Yeah. He was showing me this video today where this little girl was saying to this Christian evidences guy, you know, I can't see him, you can't observe him. No, it was some kind of hardcore atheist guy debate. And he says, you can't see God. And if you can't see it, if you can't observe it, then it doesn't exist. All right? And Yuri Gagarin famously said, you know who he is, right? The first astronaut. Well, the first cosmonaut, actually.
Yeah, he's
a Russian hero. And when he got back down after his circling of the Earth, they had an interview and they said, well, what do you think about God? And he said, well, I went up there and I didn't see him up there. All right? And people who say, I don't believe in God, first thing you might want to do is ask them, tell me about this God that you don't believe in. Because Yuri Gagarin thought that we believe in a God that you would find if you went into the sky or something like that. That's a ridiculous caricature of Christianity. Or the guy with the beard, or the angry guy in the sky, or the old man. All right? And so, you know, if an atheist tells you, I don't believe in God, you could ask that atheist, describe the God that you don't believe in. And then you say, oh, I don't believe in that God either. Thank you. Okay? But the fact that you, and by the way, you can't see God. Okay? You cannot see God. And, you know, God is not in the business of proving himself to us. In fact, I believe God's free will prevents him from proving himself to us, like dropping notes out of the sky or, I'm really here. I'm really real. You know, that kind of, God doesn't do that kind of stuff. All right? But there's a lot of things that the atheist believes in that you can't see. You can't see the wind. So how do you know there's wind? The trees start moving. That's not the best example, honestly. Because although you can't see wind, I mean, you can see the dust and all that kind of stuff. But how about the electron? How many people here believe that electrons are real? Okay, how many people don't believe electrons are real? Okay, you're just being stubborn. All right. Well, why do you believe that electrons are real? And by the way, I occasionally say this to my actual students in my actual chemistry class. Why do you believe in electrons? Yeah.
Electricity is from electrons. Just thinking.
How do you know electricity is from electrons? That's just a word.
It's
just a word.
CRT television.
Because electricity was observed for over 100 years, and the electric generator existed, the electric motor existed, electric lights existed before anybody even had proposed the existence of the electron.
Wow.
Bad argument.
Okay, all right.
Okay. So why do you believe in the electron? Answer is, because your teacher told you they exist. Okay, not a good argument. The reason I believe in electrons is because you cannot explain the properties of atoms without invoking the existence of electrons. All right, and quantum mechanics and all that kind of stuff. Okay, so the point of this is, I believe in things that aren't seen because it's the only way to explain what I can see. All right, I believe in things that are not seen because it's the only reasonable explanation of the thing that can be seen. All right, so your argument that because of electricity, that's actually not a very good argument, just so you know. Because for over 100 years, they thought electricity was a fluid.
Wow.
They didn't believe in electrons. And the only reason the electron was ever proposed is to explain quantum effects. All right, and ultimately, you know, the 1s and the 2s and the 2p and the straight p and the 3p. All right, good. What about love? Here's one. How about human identity? Stephanie, do you believe that you exist? Okay. That, in other words, that the person Stephanie exists. So, for example, Stephanie says, I want a milkshake. What's that mean? That means the person who I am wants a milkshake. Can you see human consciousness? Can you observe it? We believe in it because humans don't make sense unless there are people. And a person is not merely electrons and protons and electrical signals and neurotransmitters. I believe in the reality of love. I believe love is an actual thing. I believe hope, beauty. All right? There's a lot of things I believe in that you can't see. So that's a bogus argument against the existence of God. All right, argument number two against the existence of God is, well, almost every evil thing that was ever done, ever in history, was done because of religion, which is a gross exaggeration. But the fact is, a lot of evil has been done in the name of Christianity. All right? And it's pretty hard to defend some of the things that are done. Even today, the hateful things that are said about certain groups because, you know, they're not getting on the Christian program, you know what I'm saying? And the Crusades are pretty hard to defend. But really, this is not an argument. This is a total red herring argument. All right? Because if you don't believe in something because hypocrites believe in it, then you can't believe in science. Because have you ever met a scientist that wasn't a hypocrite? I haven't. All right? Now, it is true that evil things have been done in the name of Christianity. That's true. And by the way, we can't say, well, I didn't do that, or I wouldn't have done that. That's not a good defense. What I would say is the difference is when Christians do those things, their system tells them that that is wrong. All right? And that's the difference. All right? When an atheist does something that we would label as bad, there's nothing in their worldview that says that it's even bad. Nothing preventing that. I saw a debate between Rabbi Wolpe and, what's his name? The classic atheist guy. Anyway, on this very topic.
Dawkins?
No, Hitchens. Dawkins doesn't do public debates. Hitchens does. And so that was one of his points. Look at all the terrible things Christians have done. And actually, this was Wolpe, it was Jewish, actually. And his argument was, well, right, but if a Christian or Jew does something bad, they know that it's bad. All right? Point number three. All right, and to me, this is the closest that atheism has to an actual argument, I would say, that at least has some substance to it. Because if we have an omniscient, omnipotent, all-loving, compassionate God, then how do you explain cancer? How do you explain the existence of genocide and diseases and hurricanes and earthquakes? If God is so powerful and loving, surely he would prevent those things. Now, to defend against this argument that's against God, I would need about 20 minutes to do it, a decent job. I could do it a good job in about 40 minutes. I can't do a good job in 3 minutes, but I only have 3 minutes. All right, but I would argue that the existence of suffering is not evidence against a good, all-powerful God. Because God's job is not to prevent suffering. Besides, God gave us free will. Now, if you don't believe in free will, all right, well then, but everybody, every human being believes in free will. The atheists, they say that free will is not a real actual thing because you can't measure, you can't quantify it. But even they, I think, in their heart of hearts, believe in free will. Because if they don't, then how do they even get up in the morning? Become a nihilist and just get it over with and kill yourself. But the reason the Christian explanation of suffering is, anyway, whether the atheist accepts it or not, the theistic explanation of suffering is that a good God gave us a choice. We rebelled. We produced evil. We brought suffering into the world. And we could argue that that's a bad thing. Okay, fine. So just don't exist then. You just don't exist at all. That's the alternative. Either you're a robot. That's not so good either. All right. By the way, according to Christianity, everything God ever created obeys him. Except us. All right. And so the creation is good. And we could talk about that. But basically, the idea that suffering in the world disproves God is based on false premises. That, for example, that suffering itself is bad. Number one. Number two, that God causes it. All right? And both premises, I believe, are incorrect. Although, I'll have to admit, from a very quick glance at things, the fact that a baby is born with a horrible birth defect and suffers and dies, that does draw into question the existence of an all-powerful, benevolent God. Again, I would need about 10, 15 more minutes to do a better job of defending the premise that the existence of suffering in this world does not disprove God. By the way, there are examples of suffering in the world that are not the result of sin, like earthquakes, which is the result of plate tectonics, without which we wouldn't have an atmosphere, without which we would have sterile, you know, it's because it's a recycling system, and, you know, hurricanes and all those sort of things, weather without weather, we wouldn't have spreading the energy around, all that sort of stuff. So I would say, first two arguments, totally bogus. Third argument, it has some legs, but I believe the Christian answer to suffering is a more satisfactory answer than the atheist answer to suffering. Okay, argument number three. I'm sorry. I had other slides about suffering and the idea, so I'm going to move on, go through that. Number three argument against the existence of God. And by the way, our organization, Apologetics Research Society, set up a public debate on this very question. Does God exist? And Michael Shermer, the head of the American Skeptic Society, and one of the two or three most famous atheists in America, took the no position. And which of these four arguments do you think which ones do you think he used? If you had to guess, this professional atheist and skeptic who makes a living from essentially defending the idea that God's not real, in a public debate against a pretty smart guy, which of these four do you think he used? Or maybe more than one. Yeah.
Atheism is the default position.
That was his only argument. He did not defend that you can't observe God because he knew That's a bogus argument. He knew that. If you have a decent debater, you get crushed on that one. He didn't argue on the hypocrisy of the believers. He didn't even argue on the existence of suffering because he knew a well-prepared theist can defend that. So that was his only argument, literally his only argument. He said, basically, he threw out a bunch of one-liners and funny quips and, you know, complaints about the stupid things that Christians do that his whole audience agreed with him, actually, you know, and all that sort of stuff. But in the end, he said, unless you can prove that he exists, he doesn't exist. That's not an argument. By the way, there are situations where I believe you can argue that one position is the default position. For example, in our system of law, the default position is that you're
guilty.
You would never get on a jury. That guy is never going to be on a jury. Okay. That's how you get off a jury right away. If you say that, because I, by the way, I was at one jury. I actually ended up on the jury, and one of the guys said that, and the judge kicked him out, and he was so ticked. He was so ticked. All right, what is the default position in court?
Proven until innocent.
Innocent.
Yes.
Okay. Okay. And I would say, for the resurrection of Jesus. For the resurrection of Jesus, I would say that he was not raised from the dead is the default position. Because people don't normally get raised from the dead. You know what I'm saying? But on the existence of God, based on what would the non-existence of God be the default position? Because a vast majority of all intelligent, educated people have believed in God. In fact, atheists have always been a tiny minority. Now, I realize the majority doesn't prove something. The idea that atheism is the default position is, that's not even an argument. It's literally not even an argument. All I know is almost every successful, loved, trusted, believed in, famous, intelligent, educated person that has ever existed has believed in God. And so the default position is this tiny sort of, no. All right, why atheism fails? Why atheism fails? Number one, it's based on circular reasoning. Number two, it can't answer hard questions. And because atheism as a philosophy is bankrupt. The bottom line is, if you really try to nail down an atheist, why they believe in atheism, the answer is, because they believe in atheism. I'm not kidding. They don't have any evidence. They don't have any logical arguments. And in order to prove that there is no transcendent being, you'd have to be a transcendent being. All right? And people say, well, there's no absolute truth. Are you sure about that one? Or, you know... Basically, the strongest argument that God doesn't exist is that God doesn't exist. Now, I was watching a BBC broadcast a few years ago, and it was sort of like this round table discussion. So they'd bring in, it was like point counterpoint discussion. They had a panel of smart people, I guess, I don't know, journalists, professors, philosophers, whatever. And they'd bring people from two different perspectives and sort of grill them. And that's, so you had to defend your position in that situation. So the atheist guy, he's a chemist, he comes out, he's like, I don't even know why I'm here. This theist guy, I'm gonna dust him. And so the opening question was this. They each gave an opening statement. He said, nothing is real unless it can be observed. And if it cannot be observed and measured, it is not real. You can't observe or measure God, therefore he's not real. That was his argument. All right, and then the person in the panel asked him, well, how do you know that? All right, and he said, and all these religious people, all the evil done in the name of religion and all these, you know, fundamentalist blah, 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 religion is the enemy of everything, blah, blah, blah. And the panelist interrupted, sir, I asked you a question. You said The only thing that's are real are things you can observe and measure. I asked you, how do you know that? So would you please answer my question? Blah, 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 you know, going on. And they said, sir, the way this works is we ask questions, you answer them. If you're not going to answer our question, please step down. So he said, I guess I just believe it. That was the entire basis of his argument. People don't believe in God just because they don't believe in God. That's not a very strong argument. All right, remember, we got 3 points on why atheism fails. Circular reasoning, atheists can't answer the hard questions, bankruptcy of atheism as a philosophy. Okay, so I'm a science professor. I have a PhD in chemistry and physics. I teach philosophy of science, many situations. And I tell my students, because we talk about science and religion, we talk about science and ethics and stuff like that, and I tell my students in these situations, science is amazing. Science as a system of discovering knowledge is beyond comparison. There are questions that science answers by far better than any other system of discovering knowledge ever. Questions like, when did that happen? If you want to know when that happened, don't read the Bible to find out when it happened. Don't read the Quran to find out when it happened. Ask science. Where is it? How many? By what means? How does that work? What is the cause and effect relationship in this thing that we just observed? By what means? How many? All right? Science is really good at answering that question. But do you actually care about those questions? Is that what gets you going? Is that why you're living? Does that give you purpose? Okay. Then there's questions that science is terrible at answering. Like, why am I here? What's the right thing to do? What is my value? What is my place? What happens when I die? All right. What is the nature of reality itself? Why is there evil and suffering in the world? These are the questions that people want answered, and science is completely, utterly useless. The atheists cannot answer any of those questions. All right, why am I here? To produce as many copies of my genes as possible. Think about that. All right, how valuable am I? About $6.49. Oh, sulfur, a little copper, a little iron. Okay. Does God exist? The honest scientist will say, don't know. That's really helpful. Okay. By the way, scientists say science proves that miracles don't happen. That is a load of, forgive me, but that's a load of crap. I mean, science explains natural phenomenon. And if there were a supernatural phenomenon, science would have to say, well, that doesn't fit my natural law. That's the best they could do. Okay, good. All right, the bankruptcy of atheism is that as a philosophy, it's flat. It doesn't answer any of the questions, and it leaves us with a purposeless, meaningless life. You might as well just go for nihilism and just get it over with. All right, because if materialism, naturalism, atheism is right, then I don't exist. Literally. I mean, there's flesh and blood and molecules and you know, there are electric signals firing. But when I say I want to go to the store, I'm fooling myself because I don't even exist. Okay? If the atheist is right, then there's no soul, no spirit, no non-physical reality. Life has no value. Life has no purpose. Justice is like, how can you even define justice? Never mind support it. Okay. Atheism has been tried as a philosophy in certain limited situations. Like the Soviet Union took on atheism as its philosophy. How'd that one work out? The communist China took on atheism as its official philosophy. How's that working? The French Revolution essentially rejected religion. It wasn't specifically atheist. It was more like deist than atheist, but there you go. All right. So now, In my next 10 minutes, I'm going to provide arguments that God does exist. All right? And so we'll talk about the moral argument, the cosmological argument, the teleological argument. Those others I'll skip because I don't have time. By the way, you already believe in God, but it's nice to have an argument to present to a non-believer. And these arguments are presented in terms of a premise. Can you agree with this premise? And can you agree with this premise? Well, then if this is true and that's true, then God exists. Okay? Again, I think very few people believe in God because of these arguments, honestly. People believe in God for different reasons, but if nothing else, it can defend your position. And there might even be somebody out there for whom it's kind of like, okay, at least get their attention. Then they can read the Bible. Okay? The moral argument. By the way, you cannot prove that God exists. You can't. Now, you can prove the angles of an equilateral triangle are equal. And you can prove that two parallel lines don't intersect. Well, except there's geometries where they do, but never mind all that sort of stuff. But you cannot subject the existence of God to a mathematical type proof. You cannot prove that God exists. You can't do it. All right? All you can really do is you can say, here's reality. Here is the nature of reality. And given the nature of reality, what's the best explanation? All right? I could argue you can't prove that Ken exists. You can't prove that he exists. You probably can, but you could argue. You know, I can't prove that Abraham Lincoln lived. I can't prove that. All right. But it borders on insanity to believe that Abraham Lincoln didn't exist. Why? Well, there's some reasons for that. All right. And so when people say you cannot prove that God exists, I say that's true. You can't. All right. But I believe we can make arguments that a reasonable person have to say, yeah. All right. If that's true and that's true, then, and those things definitely seem to be true, well, that means God definitely has to exist. The first of those is the moral argument. I've got a question for you. Is it wrong to rape a woman?
Yes.
Are you sure? Yes. I'm not just saying it's unethical or a bad idea, that it's flat out wrong. Okay? So basically you're saying that is an absolute. In other words, you know, some things depends. I mean, is it wrong to lie? Mm. Not always. Not always. There's such a thing as situation. I mean, somebody comes into the room, aim a gun at your wife's head and, you know, and ask a question. You know, probably maybe lie to the guy in order to say, yeah, okay. All right. There are some things which simply are wrong. And if you disagree, then you're probably lying to me. All right? In his letter concerning toleration, the famous philosopher John Locke, he was a big supporter of religious freedom. He said all religions should have full freedom except atheism. Because he says atheism is really dangerous. Because atheism proposes that there's no right and wrong. And if there is no right and wrong, what's that going to do to a society? All right? But the fact is, there is right and wrong. All right? So, if it is wrong to take the life of somebody for selfish purposes, if it's wrong to abuse a child, if it's wrong to, for selfish reasons, just lie just to get away from the consequences of what you already did, then God has to exist. Okay? Because if the premise is absolute moral laws exist, are there people in this world who say that is not true? Yeah, an atheist, if they're honest, has to say that. If they don't agree with that, then their philosophy is false. Mm-hmm. And by the way, atheists reveal themselves and say, hey, you try to force your religion on me, that's wrong. You shouldn't do that. What do you mean I shouldn't? I thought you were an atheist. If you're an atheist, there's no should. That's not wrong. I mean, you may not like that I do that, but what do you mean when you say it's wrong? What do you mean I shouldn't do that? So atheists believe in absolute moral truth. They just don't admit that they do. But if absolute moral laws exist, such laws must be promulgated by authority that creates those laws. Otherwise, I mean, it's just all relative stuff, you know. Your morality, your morality. If humans are the result of moral truth, then there is no moral truth. So the source of this reality of absolute moral truth is, by definition, God. Second argument, yeah, so that absolute moral, that moral absolutes exist implies a source of this moral absolute, which is, by definition, God. Do the words good mean anything? Does good mean anything? Evil? Because if evil has even a definition, then God has to exist, okay? All right, the cosmological argument. Here's how the cosmological argument works. Now, to me, the first argument, the moral argument, that's a pretty strong argument. And I think almost nobody will have the courage to actually look in your face and say, it's not wrong to murder or to rape. Okay. The cosmological argument, to me, is a more compelling argument, believe it or not. Because I'm a scientist. What can I say? And philosophy actually works for me. Everything which exists has a cause. That's the premise. The premise is, if something exists, it's because it was caused to exist. Something caused it. Okay? Now the question is, are there any exceptions? Now I'm going to propose an exception. And I'm going to say that the first proposed version of the cosmological argument, that of Thomas Aquinas in the year like 1174 or whatever, has sort of a hole in it. All right. Premise number one, everything which exists has a cause. Premise number two, the universe exists. Do you buy that one?
Yeah.
All right. Therefore, the universe was caused. Which, if that's true, then pantheism doesn't work and Hinduism is a bogus religion, but never mind that. All right, that means there is a creator. Okay, the cause. Now, this argument was updated about 40 years ago by William Lane Craig, about 30 years ago. He presented what's known as the Kalam cosmological argument, which is everything which begins to exist has a cause. Why did he say that? Well, does the number two exist? Well,
kind of.
Okay. What about the number pi? What about squares? What about lines? What about, you know, there are things that seem to exist without having been caused.
Okay.
Debatable. Debatable. But, here we go. Everything which begins to exist was caused. And I'm telling you, this one is a slam dunk. This is a slam dunk. Now, by the way, good luck getting your roommate to become a Christian because of this argument, all right? Because the bottom line is they're a sinner, and they probably don't even care that you just prove to them that they need to repent of their sins. But, it's a great argument. All right? Premise number one, everything which what happened? Oh, everything which begins to exist has a cause. The universe began to exist. By the way, that has not always been assumed. In fact, Hindus will tell you the universe has always existed, as will Buddhists. Well, they won't really say that because they know they can't say it anymore, but according to their religion, trust me. All right. Anyway, therefore the universe was caused. In fact, really, to me, the fact that anything exists at all is proof of God. End of story. My opinion. How do you explain that anything exists? Ask the atheist, why does anything exist? Do you have any answer to that question? The answer is no. They cannot answer the most basic possible question, which is, why does anything exist? The only answer is creator. And the reason we can say that is because the universe began to exist. Okay. The teleological argument, it's already 8:30. We're not going to do our question and answer groups. Well, we might do question, but we aren't going to do our little groups. So I'm going to do my third argument for the existence of God, which is from design. All right, so here we go. Would you say that that object was designed? As opposed to it just sort of randomly happened. I don't know, there was a rock and some carbon and a car ran over it and it rained and somebody kicked it and boom, there it goes. That is insanity. That is, right? It is almost the definition of insanity to say that this was not designed. And when something was designed, what does that mean? There's a designer. And that designer is a person. All right? So what about the universe? So this is, it's the classic watchmaker argument, okay? William Paley. Pretty good argument. But the question is it compelling to say that the universe itself shows evidence of design? The answer is, yeah. And in fact, if you don't believe the universe is designed, I'm not sure what universe you're living in. It is extremely compelling. Now, I could do the hour version of this. I'm going to do the 3-minute version of this. Then we're going to end our talk for tonight. All right. But, yeah, this is the teleological argument. Big fancy word. Teleos means purpose. Essentially, purpose. That's a teleos. All right. So the evidence for design. In other words, there's evidence that this is just not an accident. Okay, so there you go. The finely tuned universe is one of the, there are many, many arguments from science for design. In fact, this is why I believed in God. This is why I came to believe in God initially. It's like, hello, because I claimed I was an atheist. Whether I really was ever an atheist, I don't know. I was just being rebellious, probably. But I certainly claimed to be for a couple of years and early in college. And this is the argument that turned me around, for what it's worth. All right, so there you go. There are a number of examples. Hmm? Yeah, you've seen this before. Okay, half of the people sort of saw my talk on God and science, so you're like, all right, just take a nap. But all right, it turns out that when scientists looked at the evidence for creation, for basically the Big Bang event, and by the way, all the evidence says yes. All the evidence says yes, and there's no explanation of the cosmology other than this creation event that we call the Big Bang. But when they were analyzing this creation event, they noticed some fine-tuning. All right, and so that's a small number, but it turns out when the universe was created, it was very hot and expanding, but due to gravity, that matter clumps up and eventually forms stars and galaxies and stuff like that. Turns out what they found out is if the force of gravity was bigger than it is by that fraction, the universe would have collapsed almost as soon as it was created.
How many zeros is that?
59. But on the other hand, if the force of gravity had been weaker than it actually is, again, by that fraction, then it would have never clumped. And the universe would have expanded and there would have been no... there would only have been particles. And I'm putting Francisco to sleep. It's science, Francisco. It's okay. It's all right. It's all right. Yeah. All right. Anyway. Okay, my question to the atheist. Why does gravity exist? You're not an atheist. You don't have to answer that question. But the atheist, why does gravity exist? Because it does? That's not a very good answer. Now, let's just propose that for some reason, completely unexplainable reason, that gravity exists, why does it have the value that precise? Okay? That's evidence for design. I mean, why does it exist, number one? Number two, why does it have just the right value? This is sometimes called the anthropic principle, the idea that the only way you can explain the why of the universe, which scientists technically don't have to ask, by the way, but the only way you can answer the question why of the universe is to say, so that we could exist. That's the only way to explain it. There's no other explanation. There never has been. I don't think there ever will be. Okay? Anyway, I'm done. I've used up my time. There's like 27 other facts about the universe other than like the size of the nuclear strong force, the size of nuclear weak force, the ratio of protons and electrons in the universe, the ratio of matter and antimatter, and all these other, you know, there are so many insane coincidences. By the way, according to mathematics, that number is zero. According to number theory, that number is actually zero. By the way, if you were to win the big lotto, that'd be a good thing. All right, but what if you won the big lotto again the next week?
That's crazy.
What if you won the big lotto 6 weeks in a row? Okay, that's the probability. If the force of gravity were to happen by accident to be the right value, that's the probability. Okay, so the fine-tuning, a superintellect has monkeyed with physics as well as chemistry and biology. I haven't even talked about chemistry and biology. Never mind all the other physics. All right. Those are my ontological, from desire, from changed lives, from the inspiration of the Bible. That's another evidence for the existence of God, which is the Bible. So that's what we're going to spend the next few weeks doing, is talking about that. Any questions? Yes?
Yeah, I kind of have one. It's sort of related to this, but another argument I hear maybe potentially some atheists using is pertaining to like free will.
Yeah.
So, for example, I kind of know the answer, but I'd like to hear your take on this as well. For example, like Judas, he was prophesied that he was going to betray Jesus. So did he have free will? Also, the Bible mentions like the elect multiple times. And so do
right.
people really have free will, or is it just like all point of
view? Right. Now, by the way, that's not actually an atheist asking that question. That's just a smokescreen. Because, first of all, they don't believe any of that stuff even really happened. So really, that's more of a question defending against Calvinism, if you will, or determinism. Mm. All right, and so I'm going to defend that not based on the reality of free will or lack of reality of free will. I'm going to defend the Christian idea of free will based on the Bible. All right, and the fact is that predestination is a thing in the Bible. All right, it's in Romans 8 and 9. And where God says, you know, who are you to talk back to, you know, who are you, O man, to talk back to God? Shall what form say to who formed, why did you do this? Jacob I loved, Esau I hated. And he uses Pharaoh and all that kind of stuff. God's predestination is so that we would be saved. Every time, again, this is not an argument to the atheists because they don't believe in any of this stuff. So we're just talking amongst believers in God right now, okay? Now, we could talk about determinism. That's the separate question, but we're talking about the Christian concept of free will versus God's sovereignty. So my understanding of the Bible is God's stealing of our free will is only for the purpose of salvation. The idea of the elect is in the Bible, but the idea of the reprobate, which are those who are chosen to go to hell, that is not in the Bible. It says in Romans 8, verse 32, something like that, those he foreknew, he predestined. And those he predestined, he called, justified, and glorified. So the biblical perspective on this is God foreknows. He does predestine, but not who goes to heaven and who goes to hell. He predestines the opportunity for heaven to all. Now, I know there's a Christian theological system known as Calvinism, mm-hmm. which proposes, you know, unconditional election, limited atonement, total depravity, but that is not a biblical theology. I believe a biblical theology is that God gave us the choice. That's why the tree of the knowledge of good and evil is there in the garden, because the choice had to be real, because God loved us. And God respects our choice. And if we choose to not have a relationship with him, he accepts that choice. So, yes, predestination is in the Bible. Judas is part of that. I believe that Pharaoh could have repented. I believe Judas could have repented. It was not prophesied that Judas would go to hell. It was prophesied that he would betray Jesus. Well, guess who else betrayed Jesus? Peter. Whose betrayal was more emotional? Whose betrayal was more deep? I don't know. Probably Judas's was more evil, I guess, because it was planned.
Did they do anything to prevent that? Like, you know, because God knows everything, so he knows the beginning, the end, like, where people are living.
Right. His foreknowledge does not equate with predestination. If you think about that, it'll give you a headache.
Yeah.
But if everything is predetermined, then we don't have free will. Mm-hmm. But we know that we have free will. And the Bible makes it very, 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 very clear that we do have free will. You know, Joshua said, choose this day whom you will serve. And Deuteronomy 30, verse, 18. He says, choose life. So that God gave us a choice, that's the very first story in the Bible. The very first story in the Bible is the story of choice. But nevertheless, the idea of elect is in the Bible. That word is there. Reprobate is not. And the idea of predestination, the word is right there. God's predestination is that Jesus would die for our sins. And some weird things went on related to that, the whole thing with the plagues and the escape from Egypt. That's part of the plan, though. And even the Judas thing, that's part of the plan, right? 30 pieces of silver. It's right there in Zechariah 11. So that's a good question. That's a really good question. But, yeah. Now, again, the atheist version of predestination is determinism, which says they're literally, there's no free will at all. And they've tried to use neuroscience to prove that.
Yeah.
It simply doesn't prove that. It doesn't prove that. So they've done experiments that show that the human frontal cortex is slower than, like, if you were to throw a rock at somebody, they'll go like that. And it's not their will that's causing that to happen. So we do things that are not controlled by our will. So they prove, that proves that we don't even have a will. Well, okay. So experiments have been done in a laboratory which shows that humans have the ability to do things, to make decisions, which are really not decisions at all, by the definition the Christian would want to use. Well, that obviously, that what they're saying is that everything is a somatic response. Anyway, that's not a stupid argument. It's not a ridiculous argument. It's not a terrible argument, but it's not a strong argument. So that's the atheist version. It's not lack of free will. It's determinism, mm-hmm. which is that choice. We literally don't make choices. That it's all, you know, The present condition of our brain, which is the result of things that happen to us, things we observe, our brain is in a physical state which determines what we do, not our will, not our conscious decision. So that's a philosophical position which certain atheists have tried to use science to support, but it's a very, very weak argument. If you go to my website, there's a presentation given by my friend John Beggs, who's a physics professor who does neuroscience research, and he argues that that is a bogus argument. Good one. All right, I'll take one more question or none.
Yeah,
one? Okay, one. Go for it.
John Lennon's Imagine.
Yeah, song. There you go. See you later.
Okay.
Yeah.
When John Lennon's Imagine song comes on up here, and you know, he talks, the lyrics.
Imagine there's no heaven.
Yeah.
Well, sure, except it ignores the fact that if he's right, then life has no meaning. Life has no purpose. life has no value. The source of value is God. Now, the existentialists say you create your own value. That philosophically, that doesn't work. I mean, if I was going to be an atheist, I'd guess I'd go for existentialism. But the problem with existentialism is it doesn't make any sense at all. Basically, the existentialist says, all right, it's true. Life has no value. Life has no meaning. All that stuff is just only just a bunch of, so we'll make meaning anyway. Okay, if that's your argument. Right. So it is true that some things have been done in the name of religion that are not good. And it is true that religion has caused a lot of arguments.
Yes.
It's not true that it causes most wars. Most wars have nothing to do with religion. Even the wars that we say are about religion generally are not. Have there ever been actual wars that were about religion? Yes, there have been. But anyway, it's now almost 10 of, and we'd better stop. Great question, though. All right. By the way, 2 weeks from tonight, Jen and I won't be here, so we're looking for somebody to take the class. So,
me.
Possibly. I might ask Jose to come up.
Yeah.
Thanks for coming, everybody. The other Christian Evidences talks will be more interesting, in my opinion. This one's sort of dry a little bit. I know why you fell asleep, because it's kind of boring. I was planning on it. No, it's not like I'd rather. I took them home last time, so if you take them this time, it's fine. And now that you have a job, I don't even have to give you money.
Exactly. That's funny. I just took a test about those.
Yeah? What was the class?
Philosophy.
What philosophy class?
One. I'm actually learning a lot though.